from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to the Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today we'll have an all-Sharon show. She'll talk with a poet, a professor, and a pianist.
Well, yeah, technically they're all professors, but anyway, I'll start off by chatting with poet Chris Forehand, then talk with Dr. Jim Glass about Spanish architecture, and wrap things up with a preview of the American Pianist Association's season. And we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. When's the last time you heard of a poet being solicited by a publisher? It's a good thing Butler University Associate Professor Chris Foran was sitting down when he received the call from Silver Birch Press. Sharon Gamble invited Chris to our studios to talk about his new chapbook, Rancic and Dance, why it's hard to write love poems when you're in a happy relationship, and much, much more. Chris began with a reading of The Severing, the final poem in this collection.
Wild Desire. I blame the animals, little ransackers, black-eyed screechers through our sweet rows of corn. They feast on what they find. Oh, tribe of light, I long to join. I am not a skunk. I am not filled with garbage. I have not the unearned royal mien of the rabbit, nor do I seek to anoint with musk every shrub in the vicinity. For my brooding upon an unbrooding life of requited wild desire, I blame the animals. Of what do they sing all night, if singing it is, blood on their teeth? The cricket thumbs his stubborn lighter for hours, clicking away in the dark. I shall rise one day as a flame, no swamps in this heart. A bird builds his home of what is here, a clump of human hair, a snapped thread. A dog, the scent of his death in the air, slips from the porch and slouches to meet it as if he would slobber on the hand of his master. I won't have that. I just won't.
I love the tug of war throughout this chapbook of surrendering to forces of nature and yet resisting.
Yeah. I'm glad you noticed that. Because I'm not sure I noticed that. Well, I don't know. The writing a poem is so odd because, like, that the half of you that's really doing the writing, the half that's the deepest part of the self that's doing the real work, is mainly the unconscious half. So I don't always know what's going on in the poems I write. And when I collected these poems for this little book, it struck me exactly as you say, hey, there's this tug of war going on. I never realized that.
Yeah. So tell us about the circumstances of this book. You weren't really looking to make this a book.
No.
It was happenstance.
No. And it is an actual book. It's called a chapbook. Many people are familiar with the term. It's a short book. And so you typically won't find a chapbook on the shelves of a bookstore because they don't always have spines with the author's name on it and all those kinds of things that
Sure.
Bookstores like. But what happened was a publisher in Los Angeles, a little fledgling concern, Silver Birch Press, contacted me. The woman who runs it had happened upon my poems and liked them, and she said, do you want to do something like a chapbook? And I thought, well, I hadn't been thinking of doing that. It's been a few years since my most recent full-length book appeared, and I've been writing prose, actually, and raising children since then. But I had a few poems lying about, and I knew that one day they would end up somewhere. And so when she made me the offer, I looked through what I had, and I realized I did have enough poems that were thematically connected, and good enough, I think, to put into a book. So this is a very rare thing for a poet to be solicited. Usually we have to work really hard to try to persuade people to publish our work. But she asked, and I had enough poems, and so I was happy to put the thing together. And as I say, to not really realize until I was looking through these poems that there were connections. And that's one of the wonderful things about art, if I might say, for the artist, is if the art's really working, it's coming out of the self, and you don't always know what's in there,
and not
in
the self. Not always out of the rational part of the self.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, the poems told me what they educated me about what was going on inside of me.
Whoa. Yeah. I love the conflict inherent even in the title. Ransack and mm-hmm. dance are not things that you would think of in the same breath normally.
Right. And, of course, I like the assonance, ransack and dance. Every syllable has the ah sound in mm-hmm. it. You know, that should not be underestimated, the power of music,
we need to stop texting and actually talk to each other from
time
to time.
That's right.
Sorry,
well,
I couldn't resist.
You're preaching to the choir, but maybe it's a small choir. Don't get me started. That's one of the important things about poetry is it is meant to be heard, and it is meant to be spoken aloud. Now, not every poet, especially these days, cares much about that. I certainly do. It's a very old-fashioned and therefore, I think, correct way of thinking about poetry. It is a vocal art. It's an oral art. And the sound of it, the rhythm of it, is almost everything. Or another way of saying it is, if it doesn't have attention to music, that doesn't mean it has to be pretty music. It can be an ugly kind of music. But if there's not attention to the noise the poem makes on the part of the poet, it's not going to work, because it comes out of the body. The writer's body, the writer's sense of rhythm, the writer's sensations. It is a physical thing on the page and in the throat and in the mouth when we say it, and it acts physically upon the reader. So it, even though there are denotative qualities in the language, there are all sorts of wonderful, mysterious, indirect ways that the language operates upon us that have to do with just the sound of it and the rhythm of it. So the title, to get back to your original topic, I like the sound of it, but yes, there are those two perhaps opposite kinds of activities, ransacking and dancing, although I can imagine ransacking something and then dancing on it.
And celebrating that you had conquered it, sure.
Right, but as I put the poems together, I found a way to organize them. I did create something of an arc, mm-hmm. So that the poem Wild Desire, which is the first poem, I think of as sort of establishing the foundation for the rest of the poems. I blame the animals. And so I see that first poem as establishing that dichotomy that we are animals.
Mm-hmm.
We are motivated by instinct. We are motivated by the needs of the physical body. But we also have these minds that fool us or inspire us in other directions. Or maybe the fooling is the mind sometimes fool us into thinking they are in agreement with the body.
Mm.
And so throughout the book, there's this tug of war between, being just an animal, meaning acting out of instinct, maybe acting with physical recklessness, emotional recklessness. And there's a conflict between that and the desire for a life of ecstatic meaning, maybe even nobility, something that we hope can come from true love. And so the poem, very briefly towards the end, opens the door to a love that brings some solace and some mm-hmm. hope.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think of that as the dancing. And the last poem does involve dancing.
You want to read that one for us?
Sure. The Severing. Any pistol I've touched was a toy. The hanging of the tramp, that was two towns over. I wasn't born then. And the boy roped to a bumper, dragged down a back road, bouncing. I heard about that on the radio. One section of an animal can be severed from the rest. It's swift. It's chance. I'm alive with my love. And we dance in the bedroom in socked feet, wriggling to the hiccups of Buddy Holly, whose body was silenced early, tossed to ice. And Marvin Gaye, father, gone. Oh, mercy, mercy, me, he whisper sings. We spin, leap, collapse in the sheets, happily sleepy. For whatever surgery that has cut us free in this way, the instruments are tiny and they gleam.
Mm-hmm. The longing for the violence of being cut free from the past there is kind of chilling. Is it possible to write like this when your life is full of joy? You're trending that way. You're in the right direction there by the end of this collection. But I have the sense that you're casting off a lot of darkness before you get to this point.
Yeah, you know, I have no answer to your question. I teach, and when a student asks me a question I have no answer for, I typically say, that's an interesting question. Meaning, I don't know.
If you could explain why would you be a poet, right?
Right, yeah. And I guess I can maybe try to think in a more nuanced way about it. Yes, I would say certainly you can write about misery while feeling joy in your life. For me, joy is always temporary. One is not permanently joyful. And even at the height of one's ecstasy, one is not unconscious of the fact that he will die. And that we live in a world in which things go away by definition. And so, we grow up feeling a series of losses, and those are always with us. And we live in a mysterious, inexplicable world, and you never forget that. So I think it's possible, certainly, to be happy in one's life, and in the act of writing, or perhaps in the act of creating anything artistically, unlocking that part of the self that knows those things and letting it have its say. Now, as people like to say these days, that said, as I look back at these poems, I realize, yeah, the sad ones I wrote when I was sad. The happy ones I wrote when I was happy. And maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that showed I was, in fact, in touch with my feelings. Sure. And I was letting them out.
You're married to a poet. How did you meet?
I like the fact of this because, you have only one meeting story, and if it's an embarrassing one, that's kind of a shame. This is not embarrassing. We met on the rooftop of a poet in Atlanta, Tom Lux, who was a poet, a very good poet. He's been around for a long time. He's a friend of both Alessandra's and mine. And Alessandra Lynch is my wife. We met on his rooftop at a party back in 2007. We like to think, that was a long time ago, because it's like, it's a good thing to know each other for a long time and think, boy, this relationship's really been going well for 30 years. But, we keep waiting for it to be, that's 6 years. It's not bad. We met on his rooftop and we talked about poetry, and I liked her, but I lived in Alabama. She lived in Pennsylvania. We were both in town for a conference. We had a brief, for me, memorable conversation, mainly about poetry, with some kind of funny little jabs at each other. One kind of tries out sometimes to see if the other person is game for that kind of humor. That was it. But then I was at an artist colony the next summer, Yaddo, in Saratoga, New York, and I had been there for a few weeks working on my sad love poems that ended up in this book. And then Alessandra came as a resident artist, and we hit it off, and we've been together ever since.
Sharon Gamble with poet and Butler University Associate Professor Chris Foran. Chris's new chapbook of 24 love poems, Ransack and Dance, is available on Amazon.com. It's published by Silver Birch Press.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
As an undergraduate, Dr. Jim Glass majored in history and Spanish, then went on to earn a master's degree in the history of city planning and a doctorate in architectural history and historic preservation planning. A recent trip to Spain allowed him to bring together all of these backgrounds, and he's going to give a free talk in Indianapolis about Spanish architecture. Sharon Gamble invited him to our studios to learn more.
So it seems pretty far inland to have influence of Spanish architecture. How did that happen?
Well, eons ago, when I was in college, I was a history and Spanish double major, and I followed that up with a master's in Latin American history. And then for 38 years, I did nothing with either. I went into historic preservation and got graduate degrees at Cornell in history of architecture and urban development. And this summer, for the first time, I had the opportunity to go with good friends Gene and Caroline Lyles here of Indianapolis to on my first trip to Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And was just enthralled with the country and the architecture. And when I came back, I thought, this is something worth sharing with other people.
Sure.
And I also had not done in recent years, since I'd been an administrator primarily, much with my history of architecture background. So it was an opportunity for me to digest what I had found out about on the trip. I
mm-hmm.
took lots and lots of slides,
sure.
so I had that as resource material. But then also to get books on Spain and the history of architecture in Spain and learn through them more in depth about how this fascinating architecture took shape. And I thought, wouldn't it be nice if I could sort of share this with a larger audience through a lecture? And so one thing led to another, and I decided to put together a location, which is Riviera Club,
mm-hmm.
At 5640 North Illinois Street in Indianapolis, on the north side in the Riviera, as they call it for short, ballroom. Plenty of free, secure parking, and it's a free public lecture to begin at 7:30, but a half hour before that for social gathering, coffee and tea are going to be served.
Hmm. So you've written one of your columns for the Indianapolis Star about Spanish architectural influences in Indianapolis.
Well, my column is on Indiana heritage and history,
right.
historic features of Indiana. So it always has an angle in Indiana. So
right.
what I did in that case was I had noticed that the Indiana Theater, where the IRT is, has a gorgeous Spanish Baroque facade.
Mm-hmm.
And after being to Spain, I realized how authentic much of those details and it was. And so I decided to do a column sort of telling a little bit about how the architects drew on actual Spanish antecedents, precedents, in coming up with this Spanish churrigueresque is what they call that. It's the special, most developed and extravagant version of the Spanish High Baroque in the late 1600s, early 1700s, how the facade exemplifies that, and then also how the interior, the lobby, which was retained, is full of details not only from Spanish Christian architecture, but also Moorish or Arabic architecture. The tile, for example, the
mm-hmm.
tile walls and details are right out of what you would find in Granada and southern Spain.
What are some of the hallmarks on the facade that to someone without deep knowledge might call out, oh, Spanish influence?
Mm-hmm. Well, it has what they call a frontispiece. Really, the facade is a blown-up version of a Spanish altarpiece called a retablo in Spanish, which is behind the high altar. And often in churrigueresque or high Baroque, twisted columns full of animation, plastic movement almost,
mm-hmm.
Details, sculpted details of people. For example, in the case of a retablo in Spain, it would be saints. But in the case of the Indiana Theater, there is King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella. Near the top, and Christopher Columbus, I think, is there somewhere. And there's Spanish grandees there. And then the inside, if you go up to the upper third floor inside the IRT, they've retained and preserved some of the plaster detail from the proscenium arch, which has some of the same kind of figures from that period.
Mm-hmm. Now, we don't have time for you to tell us the entire journey, but give us a little hint as to, well, before we go on, Spanish High Baroque, 17th century?
Spanish High Baroque, 1600s up to about, say, 1650 to 1750
Got
was
it.
Really the period.
Got it. Okay.
And really its most extravagant was the early 1700s.
And who can you tell us a little bit about the journey, how those influences got picked up and translated to the original theater? Of course, people know that the building IRT is in was built long before the IRT was housed in it. So how did that influence? Were there a couple of American architects in particular who said, this Spanish High Baroque look is a great match for a movie theater or a great match for a burlesque house? Or because there seems to be a lot of Spanish influence in movie theaters and stage theaters in the teens and 20s?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's two answers to your question, Sharon. One is that Spanish colonial architecture in the Baroque era was very popular generally in the United States in the early 20th century. So that was one influence. Spanish American architects were actually studying Spanish colonial architecture in its later phases from Mexico and some from Spain directly.
Was there a particular reason they were studying?
Well, it comes out of California in the Southwest, actually. Californians in the early 20th century were looking for an architecture that which was native to California.
Ah.
So they'd gone back to the Spanish missions, and from there, a few architects began to look back to Mexico, which had even more extravagant kind of an interesting architecture, and began to build in Southern California. But it also spread to other parts of the country. In Kansas City, Missouri, there's a whole shopping center in the 1920s, which is in Spanish colonial architectural style.
Really?
Yeah, complete with a reproduction of the Giralda, the bell tower from Seville, which is one of the famous landmarks in Spain. So that's one of the influences. And I think for movie palaces in the 20s, these were extravagant kind of sensory experiences for the silent moviegoer. And there were a lot of epics drawn from maybe the Spanish Main or pirate epics or, the fight of Philip II, Elizabeth in the 20s. So this theater was topical for some of the epics probably in some of the movies.
So help us go behind the scenes. Were theater owners and a lot of the movie theaters and the movie palaces in the 20s were owned by a handful of companies that would simply put them out across the country? Let's put a United Artists Theater in Indianapolis or whatever. So were the owners pretty explicit about saying to their architects, I want a scheme that makes people feel like they're doing something special, like going out to the movies, even if they do it every Saturday afternoon? It's got to be a dynamic experience. It's got to be something that wows them, that's elegant.
I think you're right on target. It's the going to the theater as experience, and as much the experience in some ways was going into the building, going through, seeing the facade, entering that building, going into, in case the Indiana Theater, through that lobby with all of the detailing, historical detailing, and the costly materials, and then finally going into the theater itself and seeing this amazing proscenium arch that recalls Spanish Baroque architecture with, again, sculpted grandees and soldiers and a asbestos curtain which had the coat of arms of Spain on it. I mean, then the organ, the pipe organ, which came out of the lower...
Spiraled up out of the floor.
Out of the
Love
orchestra,
that.
Yeah, and played accompanying the mix, the picture.
Okay, sidebar for a second, not about Spanish architecture, but just in general. Do you think that's why people still go out to movie theaters, even though we all have the technology to watch movies on our phones these days? Is there still something, even though the architecture may not be nearly as grand in many cases?
Well, maybe it's a cultural habit we've had for 100-plus years.
Ah, that makes sense. But wouldn't it be great if movie theater architects could go back to this, this kind of style?
Sure, yeah.
If there are any movie theater owners, chain owners listening, please take heed. So what a great chance to merge the two parts of your career and your work personality to be able to go back to your academic roots and finally go to Spain and see this, and then think about how the Spanish influence has or has not been preserved right here in Indiana. Was there anything, and I realize we don't have time to get into a lot of details, so we're talking in such broad scope. Spanish architecture, I mean, it's covering thousands of years and many different styles in itself. But
yes.
Was there anything that surprised you when you finally went to Spain after looking at books and doing your research?
Well, I don't think I'd been to a number of other countries in Europe, and I guess I would have to say that my impression is that most Americans don't choose Spain as their first country in Europe to go to or put at the top of their list.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe that's a mistake. I guess that's the major discovery I made, because some of the richest and most interesting architecture and original creative architecture, I think, is in Spain. It's well worth a trip for anyone who wants to see some of the best that Europe has to offer. It's a rich, layered kind of architecture. Spain, the idea of Spain, one of the things I found is the idea of Spain goes back to the Romans. The Romans were the first one to conquer or put the entire peninsula under one rule and one culture. And so much of what followed is based on the 600 or 700 years of Romans were there and the civilization. They Romanized the many peoples they found there,
mm-hmm.
to the extent that people who lived under Roman Spain tried to ape the Romans more than the Romans. And the highest distinction you could get if you were an aristocratic family in Spain was to become a Roman senator and base yourself in Rome itself. And the architecture and the engineering ingenuity of the Romans is seen in many parts of Spain. The famous Aqueduct of Segovia sort of exhibits the ingenuity, the engineering wisdom of the Romans in an act of needing to bring in fresh water from the mountains. How do you do that? Well, you build this immense arch structure, which was in use for almost 2,000 years, and bring it to the center of the town. Most of the cities and towns in Spain go back to the times of Romans. And some of the major cities in Spain were capitals of Roman provinces. So Rome itself laid a foundation, and then there was a hiatus until the Moors, or Arabs leading Berber tribesmen from northern Africa, Moors is a term that Christians later developed, came into Spain, conquered most of the peninsula, and then brought a whole new cultural outlook. Drawn from the Middle East, also interestingly, though, an architecture based on Byzantine and Roman architecture, because they had no precedence. The Arabs really had no precedence for architecture before Muhammad led them to found a new religion. And so when you go to the Great Mosque of Cordoba, which is one of the great Islamic monuments of Spain, dating from the 700s through the 900s A.D., you find this vast prayer hall with Roman columns that they had taken from Roman buildings and then put into their building with their own original arches above them. And one of the great miracles, I think, of preservation is that the mihrab, this gorgeous prayer focal point in a mosque, has been preserved. The Christians did not destroy it. It has its mosaics and its gorgeous gold work, plaster and ribbed domes above. It's a great amalgam of preservation, an inadvertent preservation story, I think, of how this great mosque was preserved.
Ecumenical architecture, ecumenical preservation, too.
Yes, although a Christian cathedral was put into the center of it in the 1500s. It's an interesting contrast.
Sharon Gamble with Dr. Jim Glass. You can hear Dr. Glass talk about Spanish architecture at a free lecture on Monday, November 11th at 7:30 p.m. in the Riviera Club Ballroom. The Riviera is at 5640 North Illinois Street. No tickets or RSVP are necessary. Just show up. Again, that talk is Monday, November 11th at 7:30 p.m. at the Riviera Club.
Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
Have you gotten your costume assembled yet?
You know, I'm kicking around the idea of going as a zombie Santa. What do you think?
That's deeply creepy.
Yeah, we'll see. I don't know. How about you?
I don't know yet. I'm looking for some inspiration. Maybe we'll find some in our calendar
that we call
What'll we wear? What'll we wear?
Well, here's something to plan for a little bit after Halloween, but definitely going to be a great road trip. It's a show called Unconventional. It's an exhibition of contemporary design that's opening at the IU Center for Art and Design in Columbus, Indiana, on November 8th. And Christopher West, who has run Christopher West Presents here in town before, is putting the show together, contemporary furniture design, and it's pulled from studios and collections from throughout the Midwest. And it's going to showcase a bunch of different designers, a lot of different mediums. The artists included from Indiana, you've got Glenn Fuller, Emily Knirk, Christopher Stewart, Colin Turry, and Lauren Zoll. Detroit designers, Jack Craig and Chris Schnack, Taryn Casella from California, and Chicago-based Stephen Hollenbeek as well. It should be really cool. Oh, also Tito Remy from the Netherlands. And so, again, this is going to be on Friday, November 8th, 6 to 8 p.m. in Columbus, Indiana at the IU Center for Art and Design on Jackson Street. Should be a really, really cool show.
Well, your time is running short to go out to the prairie for Connor Scary. Yes, Connor. Can you do that when you're headless?
It's not quite as loud.
No, I see. Connor Prairie's annual Headless Horseman events have been given facelift. Not only will you find its now familiar haunted hayride, but there's also more activity around the grounds where you can get involved in the selection of a new mayor for the creepified town. Along the way, meet Dr. Acula, Beautisha, a makeup-loving witch, Mad Scientist Ed, and other characters. And yes, of course, you were invited to wear your costume weekends through the 27th. So, one last weekend.
Fun. Hey, this isn't scary at all, but you may want to wear your best beret if you want to dress up for it, and that is the Chatterbox debut of Gail Payne, and she is going to be singing on Tuesday, October 29th from 8 to 11 p.m., and this is following her very successful Indie Fringe Festival run of La Vie L'Amour, and she's going to be singing a whole bunch of fun jazz standards as well as some French tunes as well mixed in at the Chatterbox on next Tuesday, the 29th.
Baguettes and brie not included. Hey, IUPUI Arts and Humanities Institute and the Indianapolis Museum of Art have teamed up for a talk on October 30th. It's at 7 o'clock at the DuBose Lecture Hall at the IMA. The speaker is Dr. Rachel Armstrong, who's going to lecture on the technology of nature as part of this collaboration's lecture and performance series. It's also part of the STEM to STEAM lecture series. So you can check that out and learn more. Again, that's October 30th, next week, 7 o'clock in the DuBose Lecture Hall at the IMA.
And for those of you with little ones and are thinking about what you're doing for Halloween, you might want to consider doing the Safe Night Halloween. That's on Halloween night, the 31st, and that is at the State Fairgrounds. And they're doing it in the Dow AgroScience Celebration Park from 5 to 7 p.m. It's free for children 12 and younger when they are with an adult, and it's a very cool way to go trick-or-treating in a very safe environment.
So much going on First Friday, next Friday. Wanted to give you a heads up this week, especially so much going on at the Harrison Center for the Arts. Harrison Center partnering with Historic Indianapolis for a show called Circa, a collection of gallery exhibits opening on November 1st with an artist reception from 6 to 9. It includes Enchanters, a new Kyle Ragsdale show inspired by a visit to his home state of New Mexico.
I'm looking forward to seeing that
one. Mm-hmm. Also, the Reunion Project, which you've heard about here on The Art of the Matter. That's Heron School of Art and Design alums getting together for a show. And also in the Underground Gallery, local fabric artists have created small works of art to raise awareness of trusted mentors with the theme What Home Means. And, of course, artwork for purchase throughout the Harrison Center for the Arts throughout the evening. So go browse. Remember the holidays, not Halloween, but those other holidays are on the horizon.
That's right. Hey, another art opening on that same night. Just found out about this one. It's at the Old City Hall on Alabama Street where turf was during Super Bowl. Well, this is a show called Welcome Home, and it's from 6 p.m. to 11 p.m. on Friday the 1st. And it began as sort of a monochromatic living room show with the idea that 37 different local artists have expanded that concept to include everything from texture and pattern, creating installations that are essentially living rooms, but all done in monotones. And it's free, open to the public, and it should be a lot of fun. You can get some more information at spaceartevents.com. Should be very, very cool.
Excellent. Hey, you'll hear more about this on next week's show, but don't forget the annual ANCATS Festival of Books and Arts is coming up, and so many events going on over a three-week period. Tune in next week, and you'll hear lots more about that. Travis has a great interview coming up about the ANCATS Festival.
That should be very fun. Hey, also wanted to just remind you about, on Halloween, Indiana Landmarks is presenting The Hunchback of Notre Dame and the Grand Hall at Indiana Landmarks Center, complete with spooky live organ accompaniment. And this is so fun. A great Lon Chaney film. It takes place from 7 to 10 p.m. on Halloween night, October 31st, at the Landmarks Center on Central Avenue. And it should just be a lot of fun to watch this classic with some great spooky organ music.
You do that so well. Hey, this is not a scary movie, but if you like silent films, stay tuned. The Delphi Opera House is hosting on October 26th a special fundraiser showing of The General, the 1926 Buster Keaton film. It's October 26th, 1926 film. It's a whole 26 thing there. Roger Lippincott's going to play the piano for that. It is a fundraiser for the restoration of the Delphi Opera House, which is a spectacular space, just a little over an hour from Indianapolis, so road trip. For October 26th, find out more at DelphiOperaHouse.org/events.
Very good. Sharon, that's all the time we have, but we will be back next week with that calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
The American Pianists Association wants to make sure we hear great keyboard talent, young and established. To that end, APA has put together a delightful season of artists. Artistic Director and President and CEO Joel Harrison dropped in to tell Sharon Gamble about it.
Grand Encounters? Where did this idea come from?
Well, we've been doing a concert series here in Indianapolis for several seasons. It was my idea, you know, as we program our fellows around the world, it occurred to me, you know, I don't think there's a major piano series in Indianapolis. This seems a little odd that, you know, we're trying to get everybody else in the world to sponsor our fellows. Maybe we should have something here in town.
Joel, there's not even a minor piano series in Indianapolis,
right.
So thanks for solving that.
Well, the other was that here we have all these great artists coming to play with the ISO. So we're hearing them in concerti with the orchestra, but we're not hearing them in solo formats. And, you know, we are Indianapolis is home to American Pianist Association. So I think we need to have our own series and set about to get the funding and came up with the name. Grand Encounters.
Grand Encounters. I love that you use venues around the city. And, you know, I want to talk a little bit about Idson Duckwall Recital Hall, because I think it's not as well known as it should be, and it has a pretty good acoustic.
Oh, it has a very live acoustic.
Chapel.
Yes. And is very beautiful, has good parking, you know, safe.
Mm-hmm. On the grounds of Butler.
Yeah, on the grounds of Butler. And, you know, for us it works well because we like being sort of, if you will, a good neighbor to Butler. So it gives us the opportunity to host something there on the campus. And thereby, we give, you know, special tickets to the Butler piano students, actually to any of the Butler music students.
Sure, and they get a chance to look into their future, maybe,
right.
To see what's ahead of them or what they hope is ahead of them.
And Idson Duckwall is perhaps a little on the small side for what we're doing. But as you mentioned, we like moving around the city using different venues. Typically, I use the smaller venues, and that was the other idea with doing the concert series the way we're doing it. I wanted people to, as I say, feel the air buzzing, you know, to just to feel those vibrations coming from the piano to make that piano music even more exciting.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And let's talk about, in fact, you're beginning the season on November 3rd at Eidsenduckwall with Alexander Schimpf.
Schimpf, right. And I know him a little bit. I've met him. I've heard him play. He's a gold medalist of the Cleveland International Piano Competition. I had the pleasure to be at the finals and heard him play, and it was really thrilling. Very, very impressive young man. He's from Germany. Very serious artist. This is not superficial playing. It's quite marvelous and very compelling. So I think people, and certainly hearing him in Eidsenduckwall in a size like that, should be really kind of special.
Sure. And so what did you like about, obviously he's done his homework, he's done his study, and from what you just said, I take it he plays within the context of the time period of the composer. Technical brilliance, what else?
You know, it's hard to say. All I can say is it is a deeply compelling artist with his own unique point of view that resonated, very much with me.
Can we talk repertoire?
Yeah. He's doing a world premiere of a work that was written for him. He's doing a Beethoven sonata. And then he's doing some late piano pieces by Brahms, Opus 119.
Lovely. Nice variety. And
yes,
it
is.
Yeah. Nice. You shift gears a little bit in midwinter and go jazzy on us?
A little bit. of course, Sean Chen, who we're featuring as our current DeHaan Classical Fellow from 2013, Dan Tepfer is our Cole Porter Fellow in Jazz from 2007. And we just, you know, as you mentioned earlier, we like moving around the town and using different spaces. And I've been wanting for some while to experiment with using the jazz kitchen in some interesting and innovative ways. So we're featuring both of them. The first set is primarily Sean, but Dan will join him, and they will do some improvisation together.
Oh.
And then the second set is primarily Dan, but Sean will join him and do some improvisation on that.
That's a treat.
Well, and it works well. You know, Dan is... of course, making his living primarily as a jazz pianist, but a wonderfully trained classical pianist, and he has a big CD out right now called The Goldberg Project, where he plays the Goldberg variations the way Bach wrote it, but then he adds his own variation to each of the variations, and it's the jazz improvisation.
Oh, what fun!
And Sean is primarily a classical pianist, but he improvises in his concerts. Of classical music, and we don't hear that a lot, you know, in the classical world.
Not these days.
And so their musical spirits are kindred spirits, and I thought it'd be great to put them on the same program and figure out what they're going to do. We're also going to have the piano in the center of the jazz kitchen, so it'll be a concert in the round.
Oh, yeah. Raised a little bit, though, for sight lines or not?
No, you don't need to because of the size of the space.
So, yeah. Jazz kitchen seats, 75?
About 140, depending
not
if you
many.
If you use the bar.
Mm-hmm. Okay, got it. Sure, sure. But again, intimate space, chance to not only watch the music closely, but I love this in the round because you get a chance.
Yeah.
Part of being in a live concert is seeing your fellow concertgoers, you know?
And you can do all of that in the wonderful intimate atmosphere of the jazz kitchen and have a drink while you're at it.
Yeah. Sign me up. I'm ready.
So, I think it'll be a cool evening. We're looking forward to that.
Yeah, what fun. And then in March, the day after the Ides of March,
right.
We get the Van Cliburn gold medalist.
This is the gold medalist from the most recent Cliburn competition, Vadim Kolodenko. I was in Fort Worth for the finals. I heard him play quite a bit. Marvelous pianist. Wonderful technically, but equally wonderful musically. I think he's a worthy worthy artist to be the gold medalist.
Sure.
So really, really a marvelous, marvelous pianist. And as you know, Sean Chen, we just mentioned, was the third prize winner in the same competition.
Right.
So we've got two of the Cliburn winners playing in town, actually, in the same season. Actually, we have three of them because the second place winner, Beatrice, is playing with the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra.
That's right.
Pretty soon.
Very soon, yeah. Yeah. actually, that might be over by the time our listeners hear this. I think it is. Yeah. That's okay. I hope you were there. I hope you enjoyed it. And in May, you're, I can't resist this, pulling out the big axes. I'm sorry. I'm sure I'm not the first person to make that joke.
Probably not. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the premises of our concert series is that we will feature one of our fellows, a gold medalist from another competition, as well as a major international artist. So Manny Axe fits the bill right now for the major international artist. And like many of the pianists we're bringing in, he's never played a solo piano recital in Indianapolis.
No way. How is that possible?
Well, I don't know how that's possible.
Our band
there was no
is a
way
city.
For him to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
He plays with the symphony, of course.
Right.
But there is no record of solo recital. So we think it's a great and rare treat to be able to present him to the
And group. In Schrott Center for the Arts, the new Schrott
Hall. Isn't that a beautiful hall?
Oh.
Yeah. And you know, I think it seats 450 people, which is not a huge hall.
But it doesn't feel like
no,
it when you're in there.
No, it really doesn't.
It feels very intimate.
Yes.
The acoustics, I don't know about you, but I think the acoustics are about as close to perfect as they could be.
They're excellent. Sight lines are excellent. It's a big stage, big wings. I'm told that the stage space is slightly larger than Clues,
right? Which is
hard to believe.
Which is amazing. It doesn't look that way. Mm-mm. It's a trick of the eye.
Yeah, but it's a beautiful space.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, how marvelous to hear an artist like Manny Axe in such a great space. You know, can't do better than that.
Sure. And tickets, people can buy tickets singly or to the season.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
You get a deal if you buy the season ticket.
Sure.
Of course, in essence, you get a concert free.
Yeah, sure. And who wouldn't want to do that?
I would think everybody would.
Hey, I want to shift gears a minute. You are a Creative Renewal Fellow in the class of 2013.
Yeah, and I'm so thrilled about it and grateful to the Arts Council and Lilly Endowment for sponsoring that program. It's kind of a sabbatical for me. You know, despite all my years prior to coming here in academia, I never had a sabbatical.
Oh, I'm sorry. You didn't time that very well, did you?
I didn't. And so
well,
this is my first one, and I will be in residence in New York City.
And when will that happen?
It'll be in the spring.
Mm-hmm. And what do you hope to feel, do, think, accomplish?
Well, people laugh when I tell them that. You know, according to the Arts Council, it is a renewal.
Right.
Kind of thing. Unlike
not results driven.
Right. That's right. It's not like an academic sabbatical where you have some sort of project. You're
sure.
writing a book or, you know, writing a piece, whatever it is. So in putting forth my proposal, I was consulting with people at the Arts Council. And I said, well, what really inspires you? You know, never mind your job. Take your job out of it. But what would, you know, how do you get your energy? Where does your inspiration mm-hmm. come from? I said, well, you know, of course, classical music, jazz music. I'm a big fan of contemporary art. I have contemporary art in my home, as you know, and the great music of the Western Christian Church. And
wow,
all
that's
of those,
quite a spectrum.
Yeah. And so all those things come together in New York City in a very big way. You know, major museums, obviously, major venues, great jazz clubs, a lot of great jazz clubs, and spectacular music in some of the churches. So, you know, as I was telling somebody, I'm going to go to museums during the day, going to concerts at the night, hang out and drink in jazz clubs, and then go repent for all my sins at church on Sunday.
I can't wait to see what you'll do for your final sharing for your for your Creative Renewal Fellowship.
Yeah. Good point. I don't know yet.
So you're going to live there straight through for how long?
About 6 weeks.
Yeah.
Don't have it fully worked out. It's an expensive town, let me tell you. When I started looking at rent, boy, that's going to eat up my fellowship in a hurry.
So if somebody could loan you an apartment for
just terrific, yes.
we'll help you get a hold of him if you have such a thing to offer. So was there, obviously, part of what drives you is figuring out when you can be away from the APA?
It's a bit of a trick, you know,
right.
And had to look at our calendar. There's just a limited amount of time when I can be away from the office for an extended period of time.
But was there a particular art show or concert series or jazz artist who was appearing at a certain time that helped you choose?
Not particularly. Actually, originally I was planning to be gone during the fall, but then our marvelously gifted general manager, Kim Lewis, is pregnant and is expecting. In fact, by the time this airs, she will have
There'll
had
be another
her third
new
child.
Piano patron
right.
in the and world.
So,
yay.
she's out on maternity leave, and having her out and me out for the
yeah,
same
not
period
appropriate.
Of time, not so good.
Yeah.
Well, she couldn't change her date.
No, not easily, yeah.
So I moved mine to the spring, and it works great. You know, it's a wonderful time to be in New York.
There's not a bad time to be in New York City.
I don't know. Mid-July is not so wonderful. It's hot and humid.
Yeah, we forget about how those buildings just reflect the heat. And
But, you know, the museum's, of course, always going great. The jazz clubs, really, there's no down season.
Yeah.
You know, for them, classical season does have its, you know, stronger months. And But, you know, in terms of church, I'll be there during Holy Week and Easter.
Oh,
so what a great time to go hear music.
Perfect.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to it. Come visit.
Sharon Gamble with American Pianists Association, Artistic Director, President, and CEO Joel Harrison. Find out more about their season by visiting AmericanPianists.org. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll get a preview of this year's risky Spirit and Place Festival.
I'll find out what's on schedule for the 15th annual Ann Katz Festival of Books.
And I'll learn about the Eitel-Jorgs Contemporary Art Fellowships, and we'll have our calendar of events we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.